Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us Franklin High School students. Would they stand? Glad to see you. You may be seated. And Port Washington High School students, would they stand, please? Good to see you, too. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited by the state bar and this court to come and listen to an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, they are sent briefs of the case that we are about to hear. And they may engage in other activities relating to this case. And then come to the court, listen to the oral argument, and after the second oral argument in the morning, the students will meet with a justice of this court to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case we're about to hear. Everyone is invited to join with the students to meet with the justice. Let me just ask, if anyone is not familiar with the case and would like a synopsis of it, the marshal will distribute one if you raise your hand. Good. Let me now introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Justice Butler is the justice with whom you will meet today after this case. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robensack. And on the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. With these introductions made, I will now call our second case, which is 2006 AP813, Rao versus WMA Securities, Inc. Arguing on behalf of WMA Securities is Sean Lamfer. Is that correct? You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, it's a pleasure to be here. I don't think I've been here since I was sworn in about 20 years ago.
We've missed you.
I represent WMA Securities in this action. The only remaining parties were Dr. Rao, the plaintiff, and WMA Securities by the time we got to trial. I'll briefly go over the facts. The plaintiff, Dr. Rao, has extensively talked about the facts, but I came to this court today to talk about two legal issues. Going back to the facts briefly, David Novak was the one bad person here. He was the person who stole money from Dr. Rao's account. For up until 2001, he was an agent of my client, WMA Securities. At that point, we fired him for mishandling a co-worker's check. We did not notify Dr. Rao that he was terminated. Those are the basic facts. Mr. Novak continued to steal money from Dr. Rao's account after that date. And in 2002, my client went out of business. They sold their assets to one of the co-defendants, World Group Securities. When this case was started, World Group Securities was the one who asked for a jury trial. And that gets to the two legal issues. The first legal issue for this court is whether my client was entitled to a jury trial on damages. It had answered the complaint. Before that, it had moved to dismiss. It answered the complaint, and it also moved for partial summary judgment. What happened is there were a lot of discovery disputes. There were, I believe, six sets of interrogatories and document requests. And eventually, Judge Welker struck the answer of my client. as a discovery sanction. At that point, I requested a jury trial. I submitted jury instructions and a special verdict.
Counselor, was there a scheduling order in regard to requesting a jury in this case?
Yes.
And that scheduling order had the time run already for requesting a jury when you requested one?
WGS, World Group Securities, had requested it in a timely fashion.
I understand that. My question goes to your client. Okay.
And I did not repeat the request at that point because one of the co-defendants had requested
a jury. Did the discovery order did the scheduling order limit the obligation to request a jury such that if one person requested it, no one else had to request it? Or was it silent about that?
I believe it was silent on that issue.
Thank you.
We had a hearing, I believe, on February 20th, 2006, regarding whether I was entitled to a jury and what we were going to do as far as the damages hearing. The judge, when he struck our answer, recognized that there was a fact issue regarding damages. And my position was that my client had a constitutional right to have a fact issue decided by a jury. Judge Welker disagreed. He looked at the cases on default judgments, and they were silent as to whether anyone was entitled to a jury trial after a default. He decided that it was in his discretion to deny my request for a jury trial. He did not say we had waived the jury trial. The Court of Appeals, I appealed that issue to the Court of Appeals, and among other issues, I got a mixed decision from the Court of Appeals. There were cross appeals. And the Court of Appeals also said, because there's no case law saying I have the right to a jury, WMAS does not get a jury trial on damages. My position is that the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin trumps any judicial discretion as to a jury trial.
Well, counsel, I note your brief didn't cite any authority, so you have no authority in Wisconsin. But ordinarily, we look to other jurisdictions, not because we're bound by them, because this is a state constitutional issue. Other state constitutions may be different in wording or different in interpretation. What do other states say?
I have not found any case law on this, Judge, from other states.
What about the federal law? We have a federal constitutional right to jury. It's different than ours. We also have a federal rule that's comparable to our rule. This is a discovery violation, right? It's
right.
Not a default judgment because you didn't show up. You showed up. You did a lot of things. You just were being, in effect, sanctioned for not doing enough. And you didn't appeal that.
I did appeal that to the Court of Appeals,
not
but
here.
Not to you.
Okay.
It's a fact issue.
Right. So you didn't appeal that, so you're stuck with your sanction. Now the question is whether that sanction, as interpreted by them to deny you a jury trial, is constitutional. So the federal courts, at least as I have read some of these in summary, say, hey, just like in a default judgment you waive your jury trial, when you've been sanctioned under discovery statutes, you waive your jury trial.
I think it does come down to
the
waiver.
The end.
I think it does come down to waiver. And my clients did not waive a jury trial in this situation.
You know, waiver is usually viewed as a voluntary, intelligent, and knowing act.
Correct.
To borrow some criminal law, but generally that's waiver. So the question is, you didn't waive, probably in the sense that it was knowing, intelligent, voluntary, but the other language that appears in some cases when we are very careful is you forfeited it. You forfeited by the sanctions, and the statute on sanctions is very broad, and default judgments allow the judge, the trial court, to decide what kind of hearing you get as a matter of discretion, right? I mean, that's the general law.
That's the general law and your typical default situation. But you did say the statute on sanctions is very broad. The statute on sanctions, 804.12, certainly does not say anything about denying a party the right to a jury.
No, it doesn't, but it does say that you can do default. You don't object to that. I mean, you know that you can have a default if you've violated. And one of the consequences of default is you have forfeited your jury trial. I mean, that may follow logically. You may say, well, it shouldn't follow logically.
And I say that because of the Constitution, it should not follow logically. That the case law is silent, so the Constitution controls. As far as the sanction here, as far as the waiver, I relied on WGS request for a jury, and I certainly didn't waive it. I was jumping up and down. I want a jury as far as the damages here. I don't think I submitted plenty on the record of that. I wanted a jury trial.
So let me press you one more point regarding the statute, 804.12, you referred to it. And as I understand 804.12 sub 2A3, the language of the statute is specific. It says in the last clause, or rendering a judgment by default against the disobedient party. And what that seems to indicate to me is that the court can actually resolve the case according to the statute. So is it your argument that this portion of the statutes is contrary to the Wisconsin Constitution?
Yes, that the Constitution would trump the statute as well as these decisions that Judge Welker relied on.
Counsel, there were some vigorous debates in advance of the adoption of the Wisconsin Constitution. Those debates basically occurring in 1846, 1847. Did you go back and have any chance to look at those debates to see if there was any discussion of an issue of this nature?
No, Judge, I did not. I did note that the difference between the United States Constitution on a jury trial where it's $20 any case at law, here there's no monetary amount, but that's not an issue in this case. So I assume they were following what the United States Constitution did with that slight modification. So, unfortunately, I was on a shoestring budget on this case, so I have not gone back and looked at the constitutional debates or the federal cases on jury trials. I think my position on the jury trial is fairly simple, that the Constitution controls here. We never waived a jury. Should I move on to the second issue?
No.
Justice Butler, Justice Prosser, do you have a question?
804.12.2.3. Do you challenge the right of the court to have a default judgment as a sanction on the question of liability?
I do not. The way that Judge Welker did it here, I think I would challenge that. I would think that if a party had asked for a jury and there was a discovery sanction, that they should still have a right to a jury on any remaining fact issue. As far as what Judge Welker did here is he struck our answer. He did not enter judgment in their favor in a monetary amount. He said that there is liability here. So
he did
there was a fact issue on damages. That's where I wanted the jury, on the fact issue of damages.
Are you saying he didn't enter a default judgment?
Yes, I am saying he did not enter a default judgment. That would be, in your typical case, somebody sues you for $100,000, they default, you enter a default judgment for $100,000. In this case, he understood that there was a fact dispute on the damages on the tort claims and said, we'll have a hearing on the fact question of damages. He struck our answer, said, I cannot use any of my affirmative defenses and I can't dispute the allegations in the complaint. But he did not enter judgment. He said, I'm going to hear you on damages and ask whether Dr. Rao mitigated his damages.
Well, then he entered a judgment, didn't he?
And then we had a two-day hearing, and he entered a judgment after hearing evidence.
So are you suggesting that to make this all work, he had to enter a default judgment on the default judgment but withhold judgment on the amount of damages? I mean, what's typical where you have, you know, there are lots of default judgments. And some, there are liquidated damages, right? Everybody agrees right. that if you can prove it, it's going to be $100,000.
Yes.
And then there are a lot of cases where even if you prove it, it's not.
Like this one.
Yeah, it's disputed as to how much.
Right.
So did you find any cases where you have this kind of dispute on damages after a default you have to enter two judgments?
No, I don't think they have to enter two judgments, Judge. But what they did is they struck the answer. And he said there's a fact issue on damages.
Counsel, I have this sense, and unfortunately I couldn't find the case, but that there was a case that we had that raised the very issue of how can a trial court enter a default judgment when you really didn't default? Because default judgment says, hey, never showed up, buddy, right? That's what default means. You didn't show up. Well, you did show up. You showed up a lot. And so I thought that case raised the question of whether or not you can trial court can enter a default judgment at all. Did you find that case in your searches? Because I have not yet found it.
I'm afraid not, Judge, but I think you are. Yeah, we're dealing with two different terms, a default judgment and a judgment under 804.12 for a discovery sanction. But I still believe a discovery sanction should not include denial of the right to a jury.
Just for clarification, and this record has a couple of boxes that I don't have in front of me, but at least the documents that constitute the appeal record, as indicated by the clerks of court office, document 123, is that the plaintiff is awarded judgment by default on its claim against WMA. And then that's
just the
memorandum and order signed by Judge Welker on 11-4-05. Motion of plaintiff to strike the pleadings of WMA is granted. Plaintiff is awarded judgment by default on its claim against WMA.
That preceded your hearing on damages, which I think was
yes.
February 06.
Yeah.
Yes. So there was a default judgment.
What I recalled was the decision, but you're right. He did call it a default judgment, and I did not recall that. But as far as his written decision, he did talk about this is in the appendix of plaintiff respondent, Dr. Rao, at 124. He says, for the foregoing reasons, this is Judge Welker's written decision, the motion for the plaintiff for an order striking the pleadings of WMA is granted. And his plaintiff is awarded judgment by default. Okay, so he does say default, and it's claimed against WMA. Counsel for the plaintiff is instructed within 10 days to prepare, et cetera. But he did say orally that, here it does say, still have the right to participate in a hearing on the question of damages. So there's your fact question there, the question of damages where I wanted the jury.
Counselor, how can you show that Dr. Rao failed to mitigate his damages when your employee was stealing money out of his account? How do you think he would go about doing that?
Dr. Rao received monthly statements showing withdrawals being made from his account. His deposition testimony was he asked David Novak about that. David Novak explained that these were losses in stock funds.
Okay, well, for someone uneducated in the market who hires someone to manage his money, how should he have responded? If he failed to mitigate, that means he didn't do something that he should have done
right.
at that point. What should he
right.
have done?
He should have realized that a withdrawal was a withdrawal. Every time you go to an ATM, that's a withdrawal. The second thing that happened is that he did get upset with Mr. Novak because of these, what he thought were losses,
well, sure.
and he was going to pull all the money from the account. And he didn't do that.
Well,
David Novak told him to keep some money in the account, so he could have mitigated at that point.
I see. Okay.
Did Judge Welker take any evidence on mitigation?
No. That's the Court of Appeals sent it back, so he would do that. He excluded most of my evidence on mitigation.
So we don't have a record on which we can determine whether your defense on mitigation is good as a matter of law.
Correct. That's going to be a fact issue, mitigation.
It's void. We don't have that.
Right, and I'd like to present that to a jury.
Okay, so you want this remanded for mitigation.
Yes, that's what the Court of Appeals did, to put in mitigation evidence, and then the second legal issue that's before this court is on punitive damages, whether they should be able to put in more evidence on punitive damages.
Okay, tell us about punitive damages.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
And as you tell us about punitive damages, where does the right to trial by jury fit into that matter?
That's an interesting question, too, because if we sent it back for a jury trial, those two issues would be presented to the jury, would be my position, both whether Dr. Rao mitigated his damages and whether Dr. Rao is entitled to punitive damages. So both those issues would be presented to a jury if I have the right to a jury. As far as the punitive damage issue in this case, as I stated before, after the answer was stricken, the judge basically said everything in the complaint, the amended complaint, is admitted. And that's fair. What was in the amended complaint? What was in the amended complaint, and this is in plaintiff's appendix at page 104, is that WMAS failed to notify Dr. Rao of Novak's termination. And then at paragraph 37, they said, WMAS, my client, their failure to speak constitutes a withholding of truth, the equivalent of an untrue representation that Novak was engaging in dishonest practices. My position is that it's not the equivalent. Silence is not the equivalent of an affirmative false statement. In order to have a question of punitive damages to get even close to a jury, there has to be a deliberate act or an intentional disregard of rights. Here, all they alleged and all the evidence they suggested that they were going to show Judge Welker thought, well, that sounds like negligence to me. They're being sloppy. So they didn't rise to the level of an intentional disregard of the rights. This language here, a failure to speak, I would suggest to the court that the standard has to be concealment, that somebody asks you a direct question and you don't answer it, or you give a misleading answer, or in the house cases that there's some concealment, that there was water in the basement, that type of evidence to get to an intentional disregard of the other's rights.
Counsel, isn't the first question whether Judge Welker was correct in saying, I'm only looking at the amended complaint? Now, he is now scheduled a hearing on damages. According to the cases, it's up to the trial court's discretion as to what kind of hearing, right? So he is scheduled a hearing. He's hearing from expert witnesses, right?
Right.
Okay. The plaintiff is arguing, as I understand it, that Welker was not limited to the complaint. We now have a hearing on damages, and that the request now is for punitive damages, and that the plaintiff has the right to bring in evidence. Now, what did the Court of Appeals say?
The Court of Appeals said that they remanded for Judge Welker to consider the offers of proof made by the plaintiff.
And the offers of proof go outside the complaint,
yes,
right? So it seems to me the Court of Appeals has said Judge Welker was not limited to the complaint. Judge Welker should have listened to the offers of proof, and if as a matter of law those offers of proof show no punitive damages are permitted, then as a rule of law, the judge should have dismissed punitive damages. But if the offers of proof show a disputed fact,
that there's a possibility or probability, however you want to phrase it, of punitive damages, then you bring in, you let the parties bring in all their evidence. You're arguing to us the merits of what it means. You have assumed that you can only look at the complaint. The complaint isn't good enough. And I'm wanting you to say, is Judge Welker limited to the amended complaint? That, I think, is the legal issue before us.
The amended complaint simply in the wherefore clause had a request for punitive damages.
Okay.
So that was their door for them to make their offer of proof on punitive damages. My position with Judge Welker, and we've attached the hearing on February 20th, that's in my appendix starting at 31, with Judge Welker, is that courts every day say that the punitive damage question is not going to the jury based on what you're telling me, your offer of proof.
Absolutely.
And I think that the offer of proof here, well, first of all, it was not admissible. I objected to the hearsay portions of the offer of proof. But I think Judge Welker did consider that, and then in his oral decision, he said, I'm not giving punitive damages because I don't think Dr. Rao can show intent here, intent on the part of my client, that my client did anything intentionally. Judge Welker thought we were sloppy or negligent from the evidence that he had heard and from reading the complaint. So I think even if you go beyond the amended complaint, Judge Welker heard plenty of more evidence.
Where do you find that in Judge Welker's?
Well, the two parts.
I was looking at the big appendix.
Yes. Let me see. The at my appendix. At 28, the first partial paragraph, I do not believe that if the district attorney were to prosecute WMAS for theft, such a prosecution would be successful because I don't think they can prove intent. I do not believe that punitive damages against WMAS in this case would be appropriate. That was after the damage hearing. Before the damage hearing, he made the references to being sloppy, or it sounds like negligence to me. Would you like where I found that?
No, I found the sloppy.
Okay.
I'm just not sure, after I've read the transcripts and after I read the Court of Appeals decision, whether Welker just threw out the offer of proof and never looked at it and just looked at the amended complaint, or whether Welker looked at the offer of proof and found it as a matter of law insufficient to hold for punitive damages. So which did the judge do?
My recollection is that maybe it was middle ground, that he accepted the offer of proof, but he did not make a reference to whether he actually read through the affidavit that they submitted or the asset purchase agreement that they submitted. So the record does not show that he read those documents. He said, I accept your offer of proof.
Yeah, but he didn't look at it. He didn't consider it.
I can't tell.
You can't tell. Well, then the Court of Appeals said you can't tell, so he didn't consider it. He went right to the amended complaint.
And I'm not sure he sustained my hearsay objections to those two items, the affidavit of Mr. Friedrich and the asset purchase agreement. So I'm not sure what a court's duty is after he excludes evidence and takes it as an offer of proof, what he has to do. But it's unclear as to what he did do. But he did deny punitive damages because he couldn't show intent here. I believe my time's up.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Sarah Gehrig, representing Dr. Rao.
Your Honors, if it pleases the court, my name is Sarah Gehrig of Nowlin and Mowat, and I represent Dr. Ramachandra Rao.
Counsel, you have a very nice soft voice, but it makes it hard for us to hear. So if you do that, and I think the position is okay. Yeah, so let's see if that's better. And if you center your, that's good.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, the issues on appeal are, does WMA have a right to a jury trial after its pleadings were stricken by a trial court as a result of its egregious discovery violations? And number two, punitives. Should Dr. Rao have an opportunity to present evidence to show that he's entitled to an award of punitive damages against WMA? And, Your Honors, I'd like to jump straight to the record to answer one of the court's questions regarding exactly what Judge Welker considered and what he did not consider when we went to court in damages hearing in February of 2006. In the appendix submitted by Dr. Rao on page 319, it follows a recitation of facts provided by me on behalf of my client in the form of an offer of proof. And at the conclusion of that recitation of an offer of proof, Attorney Lamphere objected to its admission, and he indicated that he was concerned that the court was going to consider that and essentially treat it as an offer of proof. Judge Welker, on page 319, lines 2 and 3, to quote, said, "I think she is, and I'm not going to." He rejected my offer of proof, and he explicitly declined to consider that evidence as an offer of proof on punitive damages.
You said, "I think I am, and I'm not going to." You leave me in the dark as to what you're
I apologize.
Thinking he is and what he's not going to. I know that he decided that there wasn't a basis for punitive damages, and I think the court is interested in knowing, when he made that decision, did he consider the offer of proof you had made, regardless of what opposing counsel said, or did he limit his consideration to the four corners of your complaint?
And, Your Honor, it's my understanding, and I hesitate to read too much into the record here from what's before the court, but my understanding of what was going on, I requested permission to make an offer of proof.
Sure.
Attorney Lamphere objected, and Attorney Lamphere wanted to get confirmation from the trial court that this was not evidence that was coming into the record. It was not being considered by the court. Judge Welker had told us repeatedly that he did not wish to go beyond the four corners of the amended complaint. In an effort to persuade him, we kept putting it in front of him. And again, he was indulgent enough to let me do that during this hearing, to recite what I would present for his consideration if he would consider it. My understanding of his comments here is he's very politely telling me, "No, Ms. Garrig, I'm not going to consider that. I'm not going to treat that as an offer of proof."
Okay. Thank you. That clears it up.
Your Honors, it is Dr. Rao's position that these issues cannot be considered in a vacuum, and I guess that's why we spent so darn much time talking about the facts of this case, because WMA's conduct, both before and after Dr. Rao brought suit in December of 2003, is highly relevant to a fair resolution of both the issues that are before this court. What happened before Dr. Rao filed suit started in January of 2000 and extended to January of 2003, when a rogue broker — we all agree that this was a bad apple. David Novak was a bad apple. He was stealing $10,000 a month from my client, Dr. Rao. Between January 2000 and April of 2001, Mr. Novak was employed by WMA in a management position. April of 2001, WMA terminated Mr. Novak for theft from a coworker, but did not tell Dr. Rao and did not even remove Mr. Novak's names from Dr. Rao's statements. September of 2001, WMA discovered a $100,000 theft by Mr. Novak from another client, Mr. Friedrich. Again, $10,000 a month withdrawals, ending just before the thefts from my client began. There was a full investigation by corporate compliance. The folks on the ground level at WMA knew what was going on. They were fully aware that their colleague had been a thief. Yet there was no action taken to protect other clients like Dr. Rao from similar thefts. No one spoke to Dr. Rao. No one took his name off of the statements. And Dr. Rao continued to rely on those statements, while Mr. Novak continued to steal money from Dr. Rao's account. April 2002 to January of 2003, WMA took what we've referred to throughout this litigation as a liability bath, selling its assets to WGS. WGS took the same employees, the same accounts, ran this out of the same place of operations in Duluth, Georgia, still carrying Mr. Novak's name on its statements. The same people who worked side by side with Mr. Novak are still in the same offices producing the same statements and still not doing anything.
Counsel, let me interrupt you for a minute. One of the issues that you've touched upon, and one that I know this court was very interested in, was the issue of jury trial. And I'm interested in knowing why you feel that under these circumstances, where there's an issue of fact in regard to damages, where the default judgment is being rendered because it's a sanction for discovery violations, why should there not be the right to trial by jury on that issue of fact concerning damages?
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, number one, because there's no authority for it, I submit. Attorney Lamphere has talked about the Wisconsin Constitution, but we've got a couple of cases. You know, I submit that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has not been silent on this issue. It has addressed this issue, and, you know, quite clearly in both the Chevron case and the Apex case. In Chevron, construing a mandate from the Wisconsin Supreme Court regarding what is typical treatment of damages in default cases when the default is a result of misconduct. That court said that the question was, does it require an evidentiary hearing or just briefs and argument? No suggestion that there was a right to a jury trial.
It wasn't an issue in that case, was it? It was not an issue. Jury trial was not an issue. No one was fighting about jury trial.
No one requested it, but it certainly, in my reading of the case, was not something that the court even suggested would have been a right.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask counsel. There's a Chevron 1 case and there's a Chevron 2 case. And in the Chevron 1 case, if I remember correctly, there was a jury trial.
Indeed, Your Honor. And my understanding is that it was the court, at the conclusion of that hearing, entered judgment notwithstanding the verdict. And at that point, essentially that was the sanction against the party that had committed the misdeeds. And then it went back to the court, and the question was, what type of a hearing should the defendants be entitled to on remand? And that was how this whole discussion arose. And the court had some very interesting language about, I hope I don't mispronounce this, a Pyrrhic or a Pyrrhic victory, about, gosh, be careful what you wish for, because it can come back and be much worse than the alternative. And I submit to this court that Dr. Rao is in that position because, you know, the time and expense and the cost, and believe me, there was a whole lot of that trekking down to Georgia and taking those depositions to find out what we were entitled to find out without doing all of that from WMA Securities, and to come back in front of Judge Welker and then present all that, the cost and expense of a jury trial on damages.
Okay. I acknowledge right up front that Mr. Nowak is a skunk. And I acknowledge that the people this council is representing aren't particularly nice people. But this case affects the right to trial by jury for every citizen in this state. Article 1, Section 5, the right of trial by jury shall remain inviolate and shall extend to all cases at law without regard to the amount in controversy. Now, you can waive that right, but this case involves whether the court can take away that right as a sanction, even in a situation where there are facts in dispute with respect to damages. Now, why should the court be able to do that? And what authority in the past is there for the court to do that?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I go back to Chevron, and the court had the authority to set aside a verdict that a jury had decided was appropriate. And if the court has authority to set aside a verdict because of misconduct by a party, I think the court has the authority to say that you have forfeited your right to a jury trial because of all the nasty things that you did. And Your Honors have read the record. I don't need to tell you the nasty things that were done in this case.
Okay, so now you look at all this audience and everybody out of Wisconsin. You're advocating for the position that the circuit court can take away the right to a jury trial for a defendant when the court says, well, that conduct is egregious. I'm taking away your right to answer the complaint, and I'm taking away your right to jury trial. I am entering a default judgment. What are the standards for doing this?
Your Honor, I think that those standards are articulated, you know, in the cases that deal with when it's appropriate to strike a party's pleading. And, Your Honor, I briefed that pretty extensively for the Court of Appeals, but I don't have those at my fingertips. But I think that the record in this case, Judge Welker found that they had stonewalled us way back a year ago. Excuse me, I believe that was in May of 2006. Then he found that they made actual misrepresentations to the court. Your Honor, he found that in order to maintain the integrity of the court, he had no alternative but to strike their pleadings. I guess.
Well, now I want you to answer this. The court could find a defendant in contempt. The court, that's right in the statute. The court can find, sock the defendant with attorney's fees. I'm sure there are other kinds of sanctions. Use this evidence. You can't use that evidence. When do you go to the point of saying, I'm entering a default judgment? You don't get a constitutional right to a jury trial.
When you've been around the block as many times as we had, and I guess, you know.
I'm just laughing because that's a pretty good standard when you've been around the block a lot. I know how you feel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Did I adequately represent?
Well, how do I know how many times you have to go around the block?
Your Honor, I guess I think that, you know, that's why we give trial courts discretion. And I think that looking at the record, had that issue been on appeal to this court, and it had been appropriate for me to pull out additional facts and emphasize those in my briefs. Your Honor, we went to court so darn many times in this case just to try to get basic answers to our discovery requests. I think the final straw for just me personally is when we went down and we deposed the folks in Georgia, and the president of WMA, who had been signing the confirmations and their discovery responses, looked my partner, Larry Barton, in the eye and said, I only heard about this case 3 days ago. The attorneys drafted those confirmations and I signed them. That was sufficient for me.
Counsel, if I may switch gears just a little bit, if Justice Prosser's had his answer to this question.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. It looks to me like on February 20, there was a motion hearing, right? February 20, there's a motion hearing before the judge,
yes,
the
Your
trial
Honor.
Court judge. Okay, and it seems that during that motion hearing, the idea of punitive damages is discussed and how you would prove that and whether you rely on the complaint or you go outside of that. And if you want to go outside of that, if that opens the door to the securities company then presenting some other evidence, and then the judge is basically saying, look, I don't want to get into a big trial on the merits here. I grant a default judgment. I just want to have a hearing on damages, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there is some discussion there in that motion hearing about how or to what extent punitive damages might be proven. In fact, at some point the court says at page 58 of the appendix, well, there's no claim here that they ever notified Dr. Rao, I don't think, or anybody else connected with this. There's obviously the very good argument that you're making that that may or may not rise to the level of punitive damages. But is there any dispute about the facts? And then you go on and discuss it more. Then you have the hearing on February 28, 06, where the court makes its decision as to what the damages will be, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it does seem there at page 27 of the appendix that the court does address the question of punitive damages and finds that Mr. Fitzpatrick is correct, that 895.80 has to be construed strictly, and it's apparent that none of the money that went, that was taken went into the pocket of the securities company other than the employee. I don't believe that if the district attorney were to prosecute that it would be successful. I don't think they can prove intent, and I don't believe punitive damages would be appropriate. And then the court goes on. So what is to drive me to think that the judge didn't consider punitive damages and make a ruling?
Because, Your Honor, he explicitly stated that he wasn't going to consider our offer of proof. He stated that we were between a rock and a hard place.
But he said at the motion hearing, you can argue for punitive damages.
But without consideration of the extraneous evidence.
Well, so you, on one hand, you're limited to the amended complaint and your request for default, and you got what you wanted there as far as having them liable on the complaint and not being able to open that up or argue defenses or mitigation or whatever they wanted to. And the court seemed to address that and be kind of trying to figure out how he can establish that there is liability, we're not having a trial on the merits, but yet not get into the underlying facts and defenses of the securities company. It seems that the court did actually take a look at punitive damages, found that there couldn't be the requisite intent, and then decided to award damages based upon the evidence presented.
I understand what the court's saying, but, Your Honor, I guess I'd go back to Apex. And Apex kind of talks about the how the statutes all fit together. And specifically, when you file a tort complaint, you can't ask for a specific amount of damages. And if you get default in a tort, that means you've got to present additional evidence. Now, Judge Welker, to be quite frank, I think was a little bit sick of this case by the time we got to our February hearing in 2006.
We can hardly believe that, counsel.
Truly, Your Honor. And I think that he was trying to figure out how he could cut to the chase on a lot of these issues. And he said, gosh darn it, if I open up the door for you, Ms. Gehrig, I got to open up the door for Mr. Lamphere. And you know what? I just want to stick to the complaint. With all due respect to Judge Welker, I think that he erred as a matter of law by failing to look at, by making that ruling, by saying, I'm just going to look at the complaint. The other thing I want to talk about, just real briefly, and I don't know if it's responsive to your question, there are two counts. We're only talking about, so far, about the intentional misrepresentation. We're also alleging that WMA is responsible for the tortious conduct of David Novak, at least either while he was an employee or while he was held out as an employee because he was in a management position with WMA. Now, that's something that was not addressed in Attorney Lamphere's, in my reading of Attorney Lamphere's brief, but that independent basis of liability for an intentional tort.
I want to talk about what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And by that, I mean I want to look at 804.12 to 2A3. And that's what the court can do if it wants to enter sanctions. An order striking out pleading or parts thereof, or staying further proceedings until the order is obeyed, or dismissing the action, or proceeding, or any part thereof, or rendering a judgment of default against the disobedient party. So if the disobedient party is the defendant, the court, as here, would strike the answer, enter a default judgment. If the disobedient party is the plaintiff, the court has the authority to dismiss the plaintiff's cause of action. What if the plaintiff had requested a jury trial on damages, and what if there were issues of material fact with regard to how injured the plaintiff was? Does the court have authority to dismiss the plaintiff's action as a sanction?
Yes. I believe it does.
Obviously, if it dismisses it on liability, the court doesn't get the damages. So it's the plaintiff would be just out, period.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Even though the plaintiff had requested a jury trial?
Indeed.
Could I ask you, counsel, if this court rules that the defendants have no right to a jury trial on the question of regular damages or punitive damages if we go anywhere beyond where we are now, what should the opinion say? What's the rationale for this?
Your Honor, I think it's an perhaps in my mind, I frame the issue slightly differently than what the court did, but it seems like it's a question of, do we extend the law to protect this party? The law, you know, granting a jury trial to a party that's in a default situation as a result of a discovery violation, again, I go back to Chevron and Apex, and those courts dealt with that, and never was there a suggestion that there was a right to a jury trial. What the way I, in my mind, see the issue is, do we extend the law to help WMA in this context, on this record? And the answer, the resounding answer to that question, in my mind, is no.
Well, with all due respect, the law didn't begin with the Chevron case. The law began in 1848, and 804.12 didn't come along until 1974. That's 126 years after the creation of our Constitution. Where is the authority in that first 126 years to simply say, oh, I don't like what the defendant did, and you can't have a jury trial?
And, Your Honor, just to take it a little bit, you know, there's a couple of reasons why I think these cases make sense. In my reading of these cases, that just says, you know, you really probably don't have that right. And number one goes to the Pyrrhic victory that's discussed in the Chevron case about the cost and the expense. The other one, again, is a Pyrrhic victory, but it's not so much in the factual context that they talk about in that case. But what WMA did to us in this case is they tied one, if not both, of our hands behind our back. They said, you can't have this evidence because we don't want to give it to you. And you know why we don't want to give it to you? Because you're going to use it against us at trial. But now we want a jury trial. So take your best shot.
Counsel, maybe I misunderstood your argument earlier, because I thought you had answered this question, and now it sounds like you shifted a little bit. I thought your argument earlier was that essentially what had happened was the defendant in this case had forfeited their right to a jury trial. That was what I thought I heard you say that a little bit earlier. Did I hear you wrong?
Your Honor, I was borrowing, I believe, from Justice Bradley's comment, the distinction between waiver and forfeit. And, you know, I guess...
And we do in this state have a doctrine of forfeiture by wrongdoing, do we not?
I'm not familiar with it, Your Honor, and that's my...
And that does apply to criminal, or at least to constitutional rights?
I'll agree.
I'll agree.
I just throw it out there for what it's worth.
Thank you.
Counsel, in Chevron 2, this court said that this is not a default judgment under 80602, right?
The Chevron?
Chevron, yeah. That it's not governed by the default judgment, because default judgment is if no issue of law or fact has been joined, or that the defendant fails to appear. But here, they appeared, an issue was joined. So it's not governed by default. But Chevron 2 said, maybe Chevron 1 too, Chevron 1 also, said this is a sanction case. And the party in Chevron, Deloitte, the accounting firm, argued that when the case went back on damages, this was a sanction of dismissal, when the case went back on damages, their argument was that it should have, Deloitte should have a hearing with all the characteristics of a bifurcated trial on damages. That was their argument. And in the first case, they did have a trial. The court rejected that argument. The court said no, that it, although it's not covered by default, the circuit court under cases, and they cited generally default cases, said the hearing is up to the trial court. That's what the law is. That's what our mandate meant. That's what you got to do. Now, I did not go back to look at the briefs in Chevron 2 to see if they specifically made the argument on juries. Did they? Do you know?
I do not know, Your Honor.
Okay. But they did make the argument. They were entitled as a matter of law
to a full hearing that they would have had under a bifurcated trial, and the court rejected that. So that's what you're relying on.
Yes.
Well, aren't you tired of this, too?
Your Honor, you don't even know.
Yet you're asking for it to go back.
Your Honor, we have an obligation to our client.
Okay.
You'll notice we did not cross-appeal this time around.
Mm-hmm. You're just sticking with the two issues, jury and punitive. Those are the two issues before us?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
There are no additional questions. Your Honor, I respectfully request that WMA's request for jury trial is denied and that the case is remanded for consideration of punitives.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lamper, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, before you begin, I have a question in regard to mitigation. Mitigation is generally a contract principle. And here you're asking us to apply it as an obligation to the conduct of an intentional theft. What authority do you have for the legal premise that you can ever apply the doctrine of mitigation to an intentional theft?
The claims against my client basically were negligent supervision. And the way I looked at this case was it was a negligence case on my side and a negligence case on Dr. Rao's side, that he was negligent in not seeing that these withdrawals were actually theft from his account and not pulling the money from Mr. Novak. That was the mitigation type issues. The other...
Excuse me, but on respondeat superior claim, you think that's still negligence for your client? You don't assume the... conduct of your agent?
On the vicarious liability claim, you are right. That is basically strict liability. What they alleged in their complaint, though, was, and this gets to some of the justice's other questions, what they did put damage amounts in their complaint. And while he was an agent for my client, WMAS, they alleged that he stole approximately $110,000. If the court wants to enter a judgment for $110,000, I think my client would accept it. What Judge Welker did was $514,000, I think it was. He only stole, by the way, about $338,000, I believe. But did I answer your question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, sort of. That's fine.
Okay. To clarify on the record, what Attorney Gehrig first quoted regarding what Judge Welker did consider at her appendix 318, I was arguing to the judge that this evidence that they had submitted on punitive damages was inadmissible. My argument was, they are all hearsay. There's no foundation for any of these documents. I don't have a right to cross-examine Mr. Friedrich. They submitted an affidavit from Mr. Friedrich. Mr. Novak, they submitted deposition testimony from Mr. Novak. The other people who generated these documents attached to the hearing brief. If they are making an offer of proof, I understand that. But if I think she's asking for these documents to be admitted into evidence, and they should not be, the court then said, I think she is, and I'm not going to. What the court says, I'm not admitting them into evidence. He did not say, I am not considering them as an offer of proof. Just a clarification on that point.
Counsel, I want to return to a question I asked of your opposing counsel, and that is... if a plaintiff requests a jury trial and the court under 804.12.2a.c, after the case has progressed in a multitude of horrors may or may not have occurred, does the court have the authority if it finds egregious conduct on the part of the plaintiff and other requisite findings to dismiss the plaintiff's cause of action as a sanction, even if the plaintiff has requested a jury trial?
I would think that if there's any fact issue that the plaintiff would have a right to a jury trial.
Well, let's take the case that we decided last year, Industrial Roofing Service. And there you had a plaintiff who started, obviously, a lawsuit, and we went through a lot of discovery and a lot of number of hearings, and I'll shortcut the facts because all sanction cases are pretty fact-intensive. But essentially, the court found that, there was egregious behavior that the plaintiff had failed to answer on numerous occasions the discovery requests, and the court would order it, and the plaintiff still would fail to turn the stuff over, and multiple hearings, and finally the court had a sanction hearing and then reserved ruling for a while and then ultimately dismissed the plaintiff's action. Can a court do that?
I don't believe so.
Do you think our decision last year was an error?
I don't think anybody has raised the question that I am raising today as far as the right to a jury trial after it's been asked. I don't believe this industrial grooming case
roofing.
Did, or the Chevron cases did. I think this is the first. This is a new issue for this court to decide today.
Mr. Lanfear, let me ask you one question. It's kind of in follow-up to Justice Bradley's question, but I'm trying to assess just how far your argument takes us.
Sure.
If you had had a request for a jury trial in the matter, and then your client just simply does not show, this true default situation, and the trial court, given that request for jury trial and given your absence, order a default judgment?
Yes, he can order a default judgment if the damages are liquidated. In this case, they were not.
And what it's as I understand what you're saying, you can order a default judgment as a sanction for your client's non-appearance. Is that correct?
Right. At that point, whether you call it a waiver or forfeiture, I would think that that would be the reasoning.
But it would be a sanction for your client's non-appearance.
Well, I think by not appearing, you're waiving any rights you've previously asserted.
But I guess the question is you've already asserted the right to a jury trial.
Right.
I'm not sure how that fact situation is that different from the fact situation presented in this case.
Well, given your fact scenario, if somebody is sued for a tort, a battery, say, and he doesn't show up, how do they assess the damages? They shouldn't be pled in the complaint. If he's going to hold a damage hearing, does he give notice to the defaulting defendant? I don't know what the situation would be, but I would suggest that that would be the proper conduct at that point, because the defaulting party doesn't know what the judgment, the amount of the judgment is going to be against him. On the other hand, if it's on a note, he does know, and he doesn't show up, and then they enter the judgment. That would be my distinction on that. You got a fact question of damages. I wanted a jury, or everybody should be entitled to a jury on a fact question of damages. One other brief comment on vicarious. Oh, I'm sorry, Judge.
Very quickly, your light's on.
There was some comment about vicarious liability. I don't believe the punitive damage statute would kick in on vicarious liability. It's just not written that way. The only person that is liable for punitives is the actor, not the vicarious person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lanfear. Thank you, Ms. Gehrig, for your arguments today on yet another discovery sanction and a sanction case. That concludes our argument on 2006 AP 813, Rao versus WMA Securities, Inc. The court is in recess until 1:30. The students should remain here, and Justice Butler will be out shortly to discuss the cases with you. Everybody's invited to stay. We're in recess.